Sorry for our late start. We'll try to move as expeditiously as possible today. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2080. Okay. With that work session open, I'm going to invite Mr. Gardner and Rich Lane, if you'd both come up to the witness dais, and we'll have a conversation about this bill. And there are two sets of amendments, right? A three and a four?
Correct. Correct, Mr. Chairman.
Does everybody have the three?
Yep. And the four should have just been handed out to you.
And the four should have just been handed to you. Okay.
Three. Okay.
All right. Why don't we look, counsel, do you want to just sort of refresh us about the bill, and then we'll get into the details?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2080 deals with the statute of limitations for product liability actions. Last time we heard this bill, there was a concern that the statute of limitations, there is essentially 2 years from the date of discovery is what the bill was trying to do. And then the statute of ultimate repose, which is sort of a different thing, is 8 years total from the date the product was purchased, as I understand it. And what we were trying to do with this bill was create this two-year discovery window, but not have that in addition to the 8 years, and not also have it so short that it essentially created a de facto ultimate repose statute of limitations of 2 years. I know those two terms can be a little confusing, but essentially right now 8 years, and under the amendments 8 years, should be the absolute last date no matter what circumstances. And then there's this discovery rule which we're dealing with. And so the amendments that you're seeing are trying to fix that. Now there is a Supreme Court decision, the Gladhart case, which was interpreting this statute, and the amendments are also trying to allow those cases that were dismissed because of the effect of that decision to be brought back to life, essentially. And the question is, how narrow do we want to have that exception?
All right. So that's where we're at, and this is not an uncomplicated discussion, and it's not uncomplicated because if you're like me, after you've talked about it enough, you can sort of get yourself in a circle, and so you have to almost draw out a little chart, starting with year zero and ending with year eight, and then factoring in the 2 years on the discovery rule. Now, why don't I understand that both Mr. Lane and Mr. Gardner have discussed the bill. There are some principles upon which they agree, but there is words upon which they don't agree, and then there's some policy choices that are going to be left to the committee to have to address. So let's have that conversation now. Why don't we start with, since it's their bill, I'm going to let you start, Rich, and then we'll go over to Jim.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Richard Lane. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and 2080 is a bill that was dropped initially at the behest of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. You have in front of you at this point a -3 version and a -4 version. Looking at those two bills by amendments comparison, I see three areas that the committee needs to decide what course it would prefer to take. Council mentioned the Gladhart decision, and that was one of the purposes that the bill was originally drafted, was to correct the Gladhart decision. Gladhart said you had 2 years from the date of injury in which to file a products liability case, and that there was no discovery rule. So the first thing the bill does is it make sure that the Supreme Court knows that in Oregon there is a discovery rule applicable in a products liability case, referring to the two-year statute of limitation. Now, the -4 at line 12 indicates that I'll start on line 11. The plaintiff is required to commence the action when he first discovers or should have discovered that the death, personal injury, or property damage occurred. Now, that's a fixed moment in time, and that's the problem with the Gladhart case. because the discovery rule encompasses what I refer to as three legs of a stool. Okay? You've got to suffer injury. You've got to know that the injury was caused by tortious conduct in order to establish the elements required for a claim for relief. What we have in the dash 3, lines 8 through 13. Those three legs of the stool are absent in the dash 4. Now, that's the first problem. You're not correcting Gladhart because you're leaving open the question of when you first discover or should have discovered the cause of action. Second point. On the dash 4, at line 12, it says death, personal injury, or property damage. 2 years. We have another case out there called Cambury. Cambury held that in a product liability death case, the cause of action must be commenced within 2 years from the date of death. That's different than Oregon practitioners' understanding because we have a wrongful death statute that says a death action must be commenced within 3 years. So, the dash 3 appropriately reflects the fact that there is a 3-year time from the date of death in which to commence the product's liability action. Well, those are the two differences so far with 3 and 4. The last issue has to do with the absolute bar of 8 years contained in 2080-4. And I believe that Mr. Gardner and myself in principle may have worked out some kind of agreement on this last point, and that is that the statute as it exists right now says that the injury must recur within 8 years and you must bring your action within 2 years. The dash fours would be an absolute cutoff at 8 years under all circumstances. So if the injury occurred in the seventh year, the 364th day, you'd have 1 day to bring the action under the dash 4 version. The dash 3 version, which we propose, makes sure that you can bring that action within 2 years. So in no event are you ever bringing a case more than 10 years. The most that it could be would be 7 years, 364 days, and 2 years. And the dash 3 accurately reflects that. So those are the three issues that I think there is a disagreement between the dash 3 and the dash 4.
Representative Brzezinski.
Just on that last part as to if it happened, the discovery was in the 8th or 9th year, there's still the prohibition at 10 under the dash 3s?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Brzezinski, my interpretation of the existing law would be if the injury does not occur within 8 years, you're barred because the 8 year, if so, your injury occurred in the 9th year, you'd have no cause of action. So we're doing nothing with that in the dash 3.
Okay.
Right. This goes back to where you have to draw the, you got to draw the timeline to make sure that you understand. If the injury occurs within the 8 years, it's 2 years from the date the injury occurred in order to bring the claim. But the injury still has to be within the 8 years. If the injury occurred on the 10th day of the 9th year, it wouldn't matter.
You'd ultimate be, repose, is
ultimate repose would apply.
Right.
So that's the part. And Mr. Gardner, I think you agree with that component. Am I right about
yes,
that?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. So those are the three distinctions between the two provisions, right? Between the two amendments.
Mr. Chairman, two significant differences, and then I think an understanding as to the third point that it would be
right.
In the 7th year, 364 days, you'd have the 2 years.
So then ultimately we're talking about the folding in of the Cambury issue, which is moving from a 2 year to a 3 year statute of limitations in a products liability wrongful death claim, and then also going back up to the issue of how do you define the discovery moment. And in Mr. Gardner's proposal, it's plaintiff first discovers or should have discovered that the death, personal injury, or property or damage occurred, and then in yours it's the three factors. Okay, so now let's hear you.
Mr. Chairman, let me start by, I'm not going to sort of proselytize, but in our view, Gladhart was correctly decided. It was a classic application of PGE versus Boley by the Supreme Court. It was a unanimous decision by a court that is not renowned for its pro-business bias, to put it most gently. And it was a decision, however, which we agree. By the way, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm a partner with the law firm of Gardner & Gardner, and I represent pharma, among other clients, including Philip Morris. It is a decision which I think can be properly characterized as having a harsh result, and one that that we agree should be appropriately considered for modification. I want to turn first to where I think we have an agreement in principle. We are not averse to a modification of the Dash 4s, which would have the effect, and I will take the most extreme example, of allowing a plaintiff 2 years from the date of discovery of an injury, if that discovery occurred on the 364th day of the seventh year. So, in effect, in that situation, you would have 10 years. We're not averse to that, and I think that that's something we can, with appropriate language, work out. Canberra is a different issue. That, again, was a very, correctly decided case, and I'm pained to hear that practitioners don't understand the law as articulated by the Supreme Court, but it's in fact a correct interpretation based on an analysis of which law is more specific and which statute of limitation applies. The issue with regard to the triggering event for discovery is a more subtle one. I hear what counsel is saying, but I need to go back and get some additional guidance on that that particular issue. That may be one in which we can reach a consensus on, as we have with regard to the 8 year plus 2 year. I want to also touch upon, however, another crucial difference between the threes and the fours, which has to do with the revival provision. Our revival provision, Mr. Chairman, was crafted very carefully after our discussions with yourself and some other interested parties to reflect the narrow situation where a judicial dismissal had occurred post-Gladhart in response to the Gladhart decision. And that is a narrower universe of dismissals, we think, than we've covered that very specifically in the fours, than I believe, at least from what my certified smart lawyers tell me the threes accomplish. So in summary, what I would like to suggest is that you give us a little bit more time to see if we can first craft and make specific our agreement in principle with regard to 8 plus 2, allow me to take back the comments with regard to the triggering event for discovery and see if we can work something out there. And frankly, I would likewise with regard to the Canberra issue, I think that may be an issue that the committee will need to resolve, because I'm not authorized to go there yet.
Okay. Rich, when I was talking to and I don't know if you want to come up on this or not, Alan. When I was talking to Mr. Tressiter, and he was explaining to me the impact of the revival language in the Dash 3s, he indicated that it was intended to solely revive those cases which have been specifically dismissed as a result of the court's ruling in Gladhart. In other words, where there was a judicial dismissal of an active case based on the court's decision in Gladhart, that it would revive solely those cases under the amendment. And that's similarly the language then that is Mr. Gardner and his folks were trying to get amendments drafted. You know, I explained that was my understanding, and that's the same thing they were shooting for, and yet I find sort of two different approaches in the bill, and I guess I'm interested in your response to that.
Mr. Chairman, we would agree that the intent is to resurrect those that were taken aback by the Gladhart decision.
Okay.
My problem, I think, is with the judicial adjudication as opposed to an action that may have been filed, and either by the party stipulation, if a practitioner reads the Gladhart decision and has a case in front of him, and he hears from defense counsel who says, you know, you don't have a claim anymore, Gladhart took that away, dismiss it, or, you know, I'm going to be forced to file a summary judgment or a motion to strike or what have you. So I think that the intent was to only resurrect those impacted by the Gladhart decision, but the actual adjudication language, we thought, in our opinion, was a little bit too focused on which cases would be revived.
And I think, and this is just, you know, obviously the committee is going to have its exercise its own judgment. For my initial conversations, you know, I think that while I understand that rationale, my concern is that just it becomes a very non-definable, difficult to define, you know, I mean, you know, I think I have a case, I call the other side, they say look at Gladhart on the phone. I mean, there's no way to really analyze that. So it essentially reopens everything. I mean, the key to the judicial dismissal concept, you know, was that it you knew what cases were there, documentable, it's a small number, it gets to people who went to the process of actually having a case filed and then only having it determined to be out. And I think that's, for me at least, the narrower version is the version that I'm inclined to be interested in. And I think that's, again, consistent with my earlier conversations with your folks.
So. Mr. Chairman, I will make sure that the amendments that we present to you the next time reflect that position and that position.
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, I'm one of nine up here, so they get to weigh in as well. Representative Przanski?
Mr. Chair, it seems to me that your perspective on this is one that if the case had actually been filed in court and there's a record that it had been filed as compared to someone contemplating it and had not made it to the courthouse, those would be included because there would be some type of dismissal that occurred getting rid of the case as compared to someone being in the office and making a decision and never approaching it. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, the idea is, look, we struggle, this committee regularly struggles with the issue of retroactivity and revival when we're changing the law. It's not an easy place to go. You know, there's some balance issues that you have to strike. On the one hand, you don't want to be changing the rules retroactively on a bunch of people. On the other hand, you don't want a situation in which, you know, as a matter of sort of fiat, people who might have had a case don't have a case anymore. And so the trick in my mind is how do you strike the balance? And I think the balance in this instance gets struck by focusing on those cases that were filed and judicially dismissed as a result of Gladhart. I think that way you protect the people who went to the effort of getting their case filed. And, you know, it's not a perfect solution. But otherwise, I think you've reopened the opportunity up in a way that there's no way to really define who gets revived then at that point. So it's just my view on that one point. But I thought it was, I guess it was consistent with my earlier conversations that I thought that I had had with the parties. Is there any other questions, committee, about this? I think I am going to obviously want to, I mean, I don't think we're ready to do this, but it's relatively complicated. Anybody want to weigh in on any of these other discussions about the how you define, you know, discovers or should have discovered versus these three factors, for example? Give our participants here today a little guidance.
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Shatterly.
If I could just refresh me or revive me. The three considerations that are in the dash three amendments, I think Mr. Lane said in the last time we saw this, those considerations come from where?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, there's a medical malpractice case by the name of Gaston versus Parsons. And in Gaston's, the court rather laboriously went through the necessary three-part analysis to find out when you actually have a cause of action on which to act upon. And I believe legislative counsel in that amendments to the dash three attempted to articulate the three legs of the stool from Gaston versus Parsons. I can give you an example of where I think this actually, you know, falls apart. you may be injured due to a particular product, but somebody tells you, well, those products always fail or always harm, and you go about your life. Well, it turns out that actually they were using faulty materials. A great example is the plywood outside siding. Nobody knew anything about why they were failing, but the injury was clearly there. You're seeing it sort of disintegrate off of your wall. But nobody has any idea that there's been any type of tortious conduct or that anybody's at fault to trigger a reasonable evaluation of whether you have a cause of action. And that's the essence of the discovery rule.
Mr. Chairman. Rich, if I could, and then I'll go to back to Representative Shirley and let Mr. Gardner comment. Isn't that subsumed, though, in the should-have-discovered concept in the Dash Wars? The should-have-discovered is a flexible enough standard that the parties get to make the argument to the court if there's an issue about how the statute applies as to whether they should or they shouldn't have discovered. If you go to the language, the sub C in the dash threes under section 2, all other elements required to establish the plaintiff's claim for relief, I mean, it gets you down a road where you're sort of, you can stretch that boundary a long ways. And it seems to me the argument that you've just made on the siding, which having represented a large manufacturer of that product, I know a little bit about that issue. The should have discovered language, it seems to me, is the language that you get to argue. You say, well, you know, they say you should have discovered it. You saw that the stuff was growing mushrooms. You know, you should have known. And they come back and they say, yeah, but we called and they said everybody says that the stuff grows mushrooms. And it wasn't until later we found out that there was this issue. And I think, I just wonder if that should have discovered language doesn't really encapsulate the kind of information you're referencing on the A, B, and C. Representative Sherrill.
Well, if I can, Richard, then you can respond to maybe both of ours. And that would be that the question would be, in understanding that the court has engrafted the discovery rule on other statutes of limitation, do we have anywhere else in the statute that actually spells out these elements? And if we don't, then if what we use is the formula knew or should have known or wouldn't the court naturally apply the same standards for discovery as it applies in all the other statutes of limitation? You know, would it be better if we're going to do this just to make this a statute on discovery at some point and then make that applicable across the board? But do we need to do that in this bill? That's my question.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Shirley, I'll try to hit it, and if I don't, please tell me I didn't hit it. I am not aware of any particular place in the statutes defining the discovery. It's a case-created analysis of what is a person supposed to have at their fingertips in order to file an action. It's that date when they have all the elements that the clock is running. You can't sit any longer. You have everything you need to know to be diligent and file. Okay? It's a case law creation, and it has been applied to other cases where a discovery rule, knew or should have known, was written into the statute. Gladhart, however, focused upon the injury or property death language that is present in the dash fours at line 12. My fear is that we do not improve the outcome in Gladhart without making abundantly clear to the Supreme Court using a PGE versus Boley analysis that we're talking about discovery rule and all of the elements that the other cases that have said what is necessary for the discovery rule. We've set it out in the dash threes. My fear is personal injury or property damage occurred is 2 years from that point. So again, with the Gladharts, the complaint indicated that they were injured on the date of sale, and yet they knew nothing until the grapes actually were ready to be harvested. And they would be out under a 2 year from the date of injury because the injury was when they purchased the goods. There would be no opportunity to discover the necessary elements.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherwin.
Could we cure that if we incorporate just a little bit of the language from the threes? Where you've got in the exercise of reasonable care. I mean, it seems to me the Gladharts should not be expected to know the day they buy their stock that it's got this latent disease in it that's not going to manifest itself 3 years until 3 years later. So in the exercise of reasonable care, they never would have known. If we were to incorporate as that much from the Dash 3s into the newer should have known, does that help bring this together?
I think anything allows the court in reviewing this statute to know that we're talking about a discovery rule as defined in the cases that you must have the three legs of a stool to trigger it is what we're after.
Okay. I'm going to let Mr. Gardner respond. I'm going to let Representative Ackerman ask a question. Since we're not done with this because they got to work on amendments anyway and we got a full agenda, I'm going to move them off to try to work together and then we'll get on to some other business. Gardner.
Mr. Ackerman, I would simply note that, you know, and I certainly don't begrudge counsel the opportunity to continuously improve their bill. Continuous improvement is a kind of a mantra of good management and good advocacy. But the version of the bill as drafted by them, the first version, unamended House Bill 2080, I'll read the operative language if I may. The plaintiff first discovered or in the exercise of reasonable care should have discovered. That sounds familiar. That sounds like the Dash 4 language. Now, I would have no objection to inserting the phrase that Representative Shetterly mentioned to just clarify that we really mean in the exercise of reasonable care. We really do mean it. I don't think there's a problem with that. But the language that that was analyzed in Gladhart and counterposed to the existing language in 30.905, in fact, was language along the lines of first discovered or should have discovered, language that's used in the category-specific statutes such as asbestos, IUDs, etc. So I can't really see this as anything more than an afterthought attempting to, you know, make it a little bit better in terms of their advocacy position. But I certainly have no objection to Representative Shetterly's suggestion.
Okay, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I was just going to make a comment, Mr. Chair, regarding the Dash 4 amendments, because as I read it, the only thing that's discovered there is the damage. Damage is the object of the discovery. And I think that applying the PGE analysis to that, that's all you're going to get. And I would worry that we would think that we would have other factors encapsulated within that concept. So I feel we should draw it out more specifically, like as stated in the Dash 3 amendments. Otherwise, I think we have a problem with statutory construction again.
Mr. Chairman, may I respond briefly?
You may.
Again, that language that appears in the Dash 4s was the requester's language in the original version of the bill. And I don't disagree with a point of clarification in terms of Representative Shetterly's language, but that was the very language that the court used in the PGE versus Boley language, set in the context of those category-specific statutes, that it contrasted with the language in the existing version of 30.905.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Shetterly, particularly, one of my more knowledgeable colleagues just passed up ORS 30.908, having to do with I think the silicon breast implant carve out of the ultimate repose, not to get things too complicated, has the three-part test for what the individual who has been harmed needs to know in order to commence a cause of action.
Mr. Chairman, what we'd like to do is take this under evaluation and see if there's a way to come up with something that's in between, perhaps, that we can all both live with.
Okay. Let's evaluate quickly. I'm going to have the bill put back on the agenda for Monday. Tuesday?
What? You can do it on Monday.
I think we want to do it on Monday.
Okay.
We want to put the bill back on for Monday, given our time frames. So it'll be back up for Monday, and so I encourage you to work together and quickly to try to get as much agreement as you can. So I'm going to close the work session on 2080.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for the discussion. It's always fascinating. No, I meant that seriously. It really is.
There's no irony.
It really wasn't.
You really didn't mean it.
Come on, I liked it. How do you not like this? We're now going to do House Bill 2498, and we're going to open a work session on that. Council, you want to bring us up to score? 2494, I'm sorry.
2494.
Yeah, 2494.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 2494 requires disclosure of expert witnesses in civil actions. You will see before you dash one amendments, which were essentially a combination. They're taken from a combination of comments that I received in holding a work group, and indeed all the next three bills resulted from a work group that I had amongst various players. Both the Oregon trial lawyers, the hospitals, the doctors who originally proposed these bills, as well as members of the bar. Essentially, right now, as you recall, expert discovery is not allowed in Oregon. It is allowed basically in every other state of the union except for one, I believe, now. What has been drafted is a procedure whereby the parties in a civil litigation must disclose their experts essentially 90 days before the date of trial. Then after that, and it sets forth, they have to put the name, the address, a resume or CV, as well as a list of cases that the expert has testified in over the last 5 years. Then essentially 45 days later, you can disclose rebuttal experts, experts who are brought forth strictly for the purpose of rebutting the testimony of an expert disclosed initially. And there's a savings clause for information or experts that whose discovery could not have been known at the time of the proper disclosure, so the court can allow such additional information to come in at its discretion. The court would also have discretion to either change or alter the provisions or the timelines or do away with the disclosure altogether. The parties would, of course, have the option to do more disclosure or less disclosure should they so stipulate. The sanction for not disclosing the expert's name and address is to have the expert excluded from testifying. There is not supposed to be that same sanction for not disclosing, for instance, the cases they've testified in over the last 5 years or giving forth some part of their CV or rate sheet. And instead, the court could order additional disclosure. The reason being, we were trying to avoid having parties argue over the how much disclosure was made and saying, you know, you didn't disclose that so-and-so earned a PhD on X date, so therefore they can't testify. We just wanted to avoid that situation. But at the same time, it seemed like the people who wanted disclosure were looking to get the name, the address, so they could identify the expert and then find out what their credentials were, who they worked for, and what cases they testified in. And it seemed not to make sense to simply allow the disclosure of the name if what they were really looking for was the other information. We might as well make them disclose it rather than playing this game where you just give the name up, because that was obviously the biggest concern of the people doing the disclosure, was that once the name was out there, these experts could be badgered somehow into not testifying. There is a provision in the language that would say you cannot, after disclosure, propound discovery on these people or contact them in any way. That's what the Dash 1s do.
Okay. Questions for counsel about the Dash 1 amendments? Representative Przanski.
I apologize, counsel. Did you say that the parties were in agreement with the Dash 1s as they are?
I do not know. I don't know that the parties are in agreement. These came out only about 2 days ago, and I gave them and CC'd them to everybody I could. I have not gotten any input back, and I assume that there may be people here. I see, indeed, some of the players here who may want to testify, but I have not heard any, you know, huge support for or against these amendments. These were just what the seemed like there was a good compromise in the amendments that you'll see on all three of these bills.
And this, so the committee knows, was at my request. Mr. Joseph led a work group among all the interested parties to try to draft some amendments on the three bills that were identified as the ones that we thought had the likelihood of moving forward out of the package of bills that we looked at. So why don't we bring up... you want to come up, Mike? Who else is here to planning to address these. You're going to find that person. Jim, you want to come up?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Mike Crew. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Cooney & Crew up in Portland, and we represent the Oregon Medical Association. We appreciate Mr. Joseph's work on this and the chair's work in bringing parties together. The concern we have with the Dash 1 amendments are several. By the way, I only saw this when I got back from Klamath Falls this morning at 6 a.m., so I apologize for not having contacted other parties. But the concept behind subsection B2 on line 16, page 1, of allowing the court to modify is a bit troublesome, particularly from the standpoint that a court could do away with the discovery altogether. And I think that we talked about that in the group setting, and I think at least my recollection was is that the purpose of modification was not to do away with the discovery of the experts. I'm a little bit confounded, if you will, by the, subsection C2 for rebuttal disclosure. If we don't have statements or information being exchanged, there's nothing to rebut. And if you couple that with subsection D, supplemental notice, I'm wondering out loud whether or not if one of the litigants wanted to add an expert 15 days before trial, could they in fact do that under the present language? My recollection of the group that got together was that was a very critical issue, that they would be allowed to add experts as long as the bill provided some method of requiring them to notify the other litigants of the fact they're going to call an additional witness, or excuse me, expert. And I question whether or not sub D would allow that. That's the concern from our point.
Okay, tell me again on sub D, Mike.
Pardon?
Tell me again on supplemental notice what your concern was.
The bill as originally drafted would have allowed a litigant to add an expert even within 30 days of trial if they gave the other litigants immediate notice of that fact. As I'm reading sub D, it doesn't provide for that. And I suspect that everyone, whether you're representing plaintiffs or defendants, is going to want to have the flexibility of being able to call or to retain an expert shortly before the trial date and call them as a witness.
But isn't that essentially sort of undercutting the whole need for the discovery? Because if you can add an expert at the last minute with sort of, you know, shortened notice, I mean, at what point do you get to do that? And then everybody just goes to that standard and says, great, I'm going to give you the night before the trial facts that says, oh, by the way, we've got so-and-so testifying in the case. I mean, you know, if there's going to be a valid discovery, which was a proposal that you guys liked, and if there's going to be a valid notice and discovery of who the experts are going to be, you got to put a framework for timing around it at some point, or everybody will just default to the ambush approach again.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, and I would be interested to hear from other interested parties, if you will, what their view would be of not being able to supplement their list of experts legitimately shortly before the time of trial. I mean, you know, for example, what happens if you retain an expert and, God forbid, but the expert gets T-boned in the intersection, is not available? What happens under those circumstances if you have to retain a different expert to come in and testify at time of trial?
Mr. Chair.
Well, again, I mean, you know, the bill can be, you know, the bill can be structured in such a way that you can always grant the court some discretion for good cause to add another expert. I mean, that's, you know, and the example that you give is a good one. You know, or that, you know, you get a phone call you know, 4 days beforehand that the expert's mother died and isn't going to be able to fly out from Wisconsin. I mean, those kinds of things happen, and you can either get postponements of the trial or you can, you know, try to find a new expert to come in and provide that kind of service. And I think you could craft a rule that would accommodate your ability to supplement it. But there's no point in having a bill if you can just willy-nilly add an expert anytime you want, and you just got to disclose it, because everybody will be given the midnight fax the night before the trial of who their expert's going to be, and then you're no better off than not having a discovery rule in the first place.
Well, I recognize that, and that's the reason, I mean, we followed the federal discovery rule when we crafted the original bill, but we took out any ability to make discovery. We thought that would satisfy the issue. And it obviously hasn't, but I quite frankly think that this proposal here may very well be objectionable to all of the interested parties. That's my
concern.
Well,
I imagine we'll hear that when we let the next two of them talk. Do you have more on this one,
no.
Mike? Okay. Jim? What he
Mike,
said?
Mike, I've covered my comments.
Okay, what he said. All right. Rich?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have reviewed the 2494-1, and when the chair sent us off to go try to work on an improvement to the bill, we did, preserving any objections we had. And I'm here to voice those objections to an identification of medical experts.
Right. You just don't like the concept at all.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman, and that would be my opposition to the bill in its present form.
All right.
I would add, though, I would join Mr. Crew in going through this bill. I was looking at Section D, lines 11 through 13, as perhaps offering an opportunity there to approach the court for the good cause. But upon reading it here, I tend to agree with Mr. Crew that situations arrive often close to 30 days before trial, and they're not on anybody's fault or reason. Experts change plans on you. You are scrambling at the last moment. A retained expert says, well, I can't answer that. You're going to have to get somebody else with a different discipline or expertise. And through nobody's fault, you have to retain and get another expert up to speed. And there ought to be some kind of good cause allowance, as Representative Pruzanski mentioned, for you to approach the court and say, this happened, Your Honor.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
Well, just looking back at the rule, the bill as drafted, I mean, that still has the same problems, doesn't it, as far as supplemental disclosure? That really isn't a problem that is created by the Dash 1 amendments. That looks to me like that's a latent problem even in the original draft.
Well,
because you've got that 30-day period, and then, looking at supplemental notice, it seems to me that the Dash 1s track pretty much along the same line as the supplemental notice provisions in the original bill. So to the extent that they create a problem, that problem was in the original bill to begin with.
Well, it was our view under the original bill that if indeed you... Because of the exchange of information, reports, if indeed you needed to call a rebuttal witness, you could do that, and that was the purpose of subsection D under supplemental notice. Now, maybe I was grossly in error in the first instance when I was looking at the original bill, but I...
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Representative Sherrill.
So the D, though, doesn't really... It's not limited in application to rebuttal. It's just anybody's expert.
Right.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Are there any other questions, comments? Representative Ackerman.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. As long as this may be going back for some reworking, we might want to consider a more definitive. Well, there's no effective date on this, and I'm afraid that without that, we could have an effective date that might hit right in the middle of somebody's trial, and that would raise somewhat of a havoc. So maybe that does need a little bit of work.
Okay. Good point. All right. Thank you. Anybody else who wants to come up and talk about this one? All right. I'm going to close the work session on 2494, and open a work session on 2498. Same team on this one, too?
I think so.
You guys all going to? All right. Good enough.
Why break up a good team?
Let's talk about this one, counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, I met with the same group on this bill, and this one is quite a bit more simple. We talked about last time setting an interest rate that was somewhat lower than the current 9% on all civil judgments, whereas the original bill was limited to essentially judgments against medical practitioners. The Dash 1 amendments that you should see sets exactly the same rate as is in federal court. There was some discussion as to having a bump for state court or not having a bump, or should we cap it, or should we put a floor on it? And it seemed like there was just the best compromise was just to make the federal interest rate and the same for the state, essentially the federal funds rate. And it's my understanding that that's what the Dash 1 amendments do.
All right. Who wants to go first on this one?
Well, again, Mr. Chairman, Mike Crew, on behalf of the OMA, I think that Mr. Joseph has in fact crafted the bill as we discussed, and certainly we support the Dash 1 amendments.
All right. Mr. Dorgan?
We also support the Dash 1 amendments.
You're doing a good job today, Mr. Dorgan. Rich?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we would also support the Dash 1 amendments.
Everybody likes the Dash 1s.
Mr. Chair, I got a motion for you.
Wait a second.
Hold on. Hold on. It's nothing that easy. Nothing's going on here. Lane?
Well, the question I have is, this is great when you've got clients represented by legal counsel that has access to and can figure out what they. I assume this interest rate applies in small claims cases as well. How is a small claims claimant ever going to? Well, I mean, I know the folks I send to small claims to file, and this is going to be a little challenge to figure out.
Well, you know, the way it works in federal court, in my experience, is that you pick up the phone and you call the office and you say, as you're preparing the judgment, there's a woman on the end of the phone.
They got rid of her.
This is the federal court, at the federal courthouse, and my experience has always been she answers the phone and you ask what the rate is, and she can tell you what the daily rate is, and you plug that into your judgment. Okay. Now, whether or not the state courts would be able to have somebody who could do that is a different discussion. And Mr. Marquis, when we're done here, we'll go ahead and let Mr. Crew talk here, but are you going to want to talk about this one, Jim? No, I mean, you're sitting there. I just wonder if this is the one you're hanging out for.
We have.
All right. Well, that's...
There goes my motion.
Yeah.
Well, no, Mr. Chair, I like this. It is a question of practicalities, is my concern, knowing the volume of cases that the courts process through small claims and the challenges that this could present both for the courts and for litigants, I think, in ever knowing exactly what their rate of interest is supposed to be and knowing that we have pre-printed small claims forms and everything, how you do that?
Yeah, I mean, the flip side, obviously, is that, you know, a 9%, you know, per annum interest rate, you know, stuck in statute that doesn't demonstrate sort of any level of flexibility. Yeah. And, you know, narrowing it to just one particular class of cases seems also somewhat incongruous, I guess. So,
like I said, I'm not opposing. It's just maybe Jim can tell us how the practicalities of this might work.
Mr. Crew?
Mr. Chairman, if you get on the web and look up the Federal Board of the Federal Reserve System, it has this interest rate. It has about 40 different interest rates. You just push the button, it'll give you a 40-year history by week of what this interest rate is.
I didn't even know that. That saves me a phone call now.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I suspect that it could probably be posted in the courthouse as close to where you'd file. They could just change it, maybe. Doesn't seem to be that much of a problem.
Okay. All right. Any other questions for these three? Okay. Thank you. Mr. Marquis.
Was that trash talk?
Yes, it was.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association. I We have not been involved in these discussions, and I'm not sure what the effect of these amendments actually will be on our state court system, and particularly in the small claims area. As you know, we went through extensive negotiations just to get a portion of small claims even moved forward in this day of budget crisis. And I know the courts are very, very short of staff, and we're just somewhat concerned about how all this might work and trying to figure out in a very short time frame how it might work. I would like to take this back and have some discussions with the courts. But
all right, other questions for Mr. Markey? I mean, you know, Jim, I recognize that, you know, the 9%, the adjustment of the rate isn't necessarily going to be welcomed by, you know, a lot of your clients, because 9% is a pretty good rate right now. I wish I had a few outstanding judgments myself that'd be beating my portfolio. But at the same time, tying it to the federal rate is a floating rate, given our current environment, seems a whole lot more practical over time, despite the complexity that might be involved. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Mr. Chair, I understand completely that argument, and I've represented the collectors long enough to know that when interest rates are very high, they want me to introduce a bill to raise this number, and other times they want me to be quiet. So, I mean, I understand that has some inflexibility, and certainly I can't argue against some kind of a movement in this area. I just, again, haven't been a party to these discussions and probably should have been, and that's entirely my fault.
Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Markey? All right. Thanks, Jim.
He's gotten close.
On deck, Brad Swank.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brad Swank, Special Counsel for Government Relations for the State Court Administrator's Office. Probably we would not be in the business of posting interest rates, and it's not just a staffing issue, although it is a staffing issue. We don't have people who chase down those kinds of things. We would not want to be put in the position of advising people about certain potentially legal issues upon which they would rely and which might make us liable if we got them wrong. And the people, like I say, we don't currently have people who check out these interest rates and post them. We don't currently have people in general who advise on legal rights and those sorts of things, people who file for small claims, and that's because of the potential liabilities that would be involved. And we do handle generally a lot of small claims. We're not handling a lot of small claims right now, but as of June 30, we probably will again. So this would be something that would be of concern for us if you were predicating this on the theory that somehow courts were going to be providing people with the legal interest rate du jour, that they would be adding to their small claims or other interest rates.
Brad. But there wouldn't be anything that would prohibit the court from posting a sign in front of the filing area giving the website where someone could look up the legal interest rate du jour on their own, is there?
I don't know. I mean, I know that various people find...
How could that be a problem, though?
I know...
If there's a federal treasury rate, Brad, that you can get off the Internet by logging on to a website ran by the federal government, and you just say, if you're interested in what the current federal interest rate is that you can charge in your judgment, here's a federal website to the federal treasury that you can log on to, how would that be a problem? Then the person who's doing this on their own could walk up the street to the county library, get on the Internet, and see the rate for themselves. And then you're not in the business of handing out legal advice.
Well, websites change. I mean, we don't, it's not something that currently we do. We don't currently track, we don't currently keep up on the interest rate, those sorts of things. It's the responsibility of something else. Initially, when you were talking about this, you were talking about somebody calling up the court and somebody at the court going, well, the interest rate is such and such. And now you're going, well, could you post a website? Do we have to track the website? Is it something? How you sort of add peripheral workload to courts when somebody calls up and say, well, could you go, have you looked up the website recently? You know, could you go tell me what it is? People who give calls, those sorts of things, it's counter work. And my initial response was to the concern about somebody being able to call up the courthouse and get the interest rate. And it's probably not a position that we're going to be able to, a role that we're going to be able to fill. You're saying, is there some other way you can fulfill it, some meaningful way? Well,
no, I'm just saying, is there a way you could provide the person who's walking into the courthouse with some direction about where they could get that information by putting a sign up?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, it is not something we currently do.
Well, I read, because you don't need to, because it's in statute.
That's correct.
Right, okay. Representative Shaw.
Well, I'm sorry for having let us into this thicket. let me see if I can offer a way out. Perhaps, I think the bill does a good thing, and I'd be inclined to go ahead and move it forward and maybe suggest, because there's one issue. One is an issue of access to the information, I think, for your unrepresented folks in small claims. And the other is, especially if there's 40 rates on the website, are they going to get it right? And what happens when they pick the wrong number and plug it into the judgment? Who's going to be responsible for correcting that or even making sure that it was right or not right? You know, one thing we could ask Mr. Marquis to consider to catch up on the Senate side would be maybe a fixed rate of 6% or something in small claims cases, so that, you know, we're adjusting down the rate for, and that's what happened when we adjusted this up to 9%. We were kind of catching up the fixed judgment interest rate with the current market, and maybe we could set a rate for small claims cases so we don't have to worry about this for small claims. But I'd be happy to go ahead and move the bill forward anyway and get it over in the Senate, because I think we're going in the right direction.
Discussion. All right. Well, I'm unresolved, I guess. So I'm going to close the work session on 2498. Going to open a work session on 2591. Council?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, House Bill 2591 started as a bill that would require judgments to be entered and paid in installment payments for medical malpractice cases where the judgment is over $100,000. Following the same work group, it seemed like there was a consensus to raise the amount that this would apply to something over $500,000, and also to make it more, put the burden on the party requesting such an installment plan to make a showing to the court, one, that the installment plan was appropriate, and two, how to structure the installment plan, because the IRS code will change over time, and it seemed problematic to set forth an installment plan in our statutes that would have to be just kind of that's what the court would go with, or the court wouldn't go with one. And here this provides a process for the party seeking to have the payment plan put in place to make a motion to the court. They would have to put forth all the supporting information. If an actuary or an accountant was needed to structure the plan, the moving party would have the burden of hiring that person and having them make the proposal to the court. Of course, the other party could always stipulate to the plan, but assuming that isn't the case, the Dash 1 amendments, as you see them, contemplates that the court would then take the motion, and we assume hear some oral argument on it, and take the plan into consideration and look at a couple different factors that we've laid out and any other factor the court deems appropriate, and then either say yay or nay on the plan or modify it in some way. So that was the idea of the statute, and that's what you see in the Dash 1 amendments.
All right. Is it the same? Is it our same three again? Mr. Crew, Mr. Dorgan, Mr. Lyon.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Mike Crew, on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association, The primary objection that the OMA has to the proposed amendments is that it does not make the periodic payment mandatory. And practically speaking, it's our view that unless it's made mandatory, this really doesn't change, won't change the current environment that I think is predictable, that the court would be reluctant to place or to require a plaintiff to receive their payments periodically. There are other issues with the bill, and this is pretty technical stuff, and I'll turn to Mr. Dorrigan to raise some of those issues that the OMA would agree with.
Mr. Dorrigan.
Thank you, Chairman Williams. The issues that we have with this relate to the bill not matching up well to the MICRA bill or the California periodic payments provision. And the issues, as I look at it in this particular bill and the amendments, first, this bill does not specify that payments end in the event of death, so that in the event of anticipated future economic damages and non-economic damages, that in the event that you buy a structured settlement, which is how most of these will be paid, that it doesn't specify how those future payments will end. And the design of that is that in these types of cases, there are generally a stream of payments that get the economic damages up to a very large amount that do not reflect the actual losses that and costs that are there. So I think we need to look to match up on the provision there. The other provision that creates a problem here is Section 6, where it says a judgment entered under subsection 1 of this section may not increase the amount awarded by the trier of fact, except to the extent that installment payments must include interest attributable to deferred payment sub the amounts awarded. Where the California statute clarifies this is that it clarifies that the amount of the judgment is a gross amount and it's not reduced to present value. And what happens is in the event that you've got a stream of payments, it's the anticipated gross amount, and then it allows the defendant to structure the payments to meet the needs of the plaintiff in the case. And in that way, what it does is it allows you to buy an annuity, and usually when those annuities are purchased, you get two insurance companies, one to provide the annuity, one to guarantee the annuity, and it matches up to the needs presented at time of trial, so that you present the structure to the court, and the court reviews that as compared to the evidence on the stream of payments required to take care of the injured party. So I think we really have to go back to the California statute and look at making sure that it reflects the gross payment, and then provides for termination in the event of death for anticipated future payments, and then it comes back with a carve-out that accepts the anticipated lost wages of the person going forward. So it doesn't provide for an added windfall in the event that they penciled economic damages out to be $10 million and the person in fact dies shortly thereafter. So I think it needs a lot of work before we would step in and support.
Okay, Mr. Lane.
I'll wait. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Richard Lane appearing on behalf of the Trial Lawyers Association, and we do oppose the 2591-1 amendments. The fact that it is discretionary with the court is the only thing that is a bright spot in the Dash 1 as opposed to the first bill, which made it mandatory all the time. The language that Mr. Dorrigan was just explaining, characterizing as a potential double windfall, that is necessary language to prevent any double reduction that actually is paid out over the course of the annuity. There's problems in this bill, at least from my technical people, tell me that because there could be an argument that the plaintiff is in constructive receipt of the verdict prior to the time that any annuity is actually entered, it may cause a loss of the tax benefits associated with a personal injury award not being under taxable under the federal code. There's no provision for a reduction in Section 1A for the costs, expenses associated with bringing a case. Those are going to have to be reduced from any amount that's going to be considered for the structured payment plan. The Section 1C, starting on line 12, indicates that future economics would have to be paid in installments. It's my experience at least ORS 656, the workers' compensation scheme, indicates that future payments that are expected to be paid must be reduced to present value and paid upon the judgment. They're not going to wait, or you're going to have inconsistent statutes here about whether the comp carriers are going to accept an installment payment on the future benefits that they're paying. The same thing with many private carriers. If they're expected to pay both past and futures, they want them at the time of any judgment. Same thing with the United States government by USC provision. So you're going to have to make sure that the amount of money that the court is considering putting into any stream of structured payment is actually the money that the individual injured person has after payment of all past medical expenses, payment, if necessary, of future medical expenses, reduction and reimbursement for all costs associated with bringing the case. And this bill doesn't do that.
All right. Questions? Representative Rozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to go back to the MICA part, or at least what I thought I heard. Under that plan, defendants get to determine how to pay the damages to the plaintiff based on the defendant's determination of what the needs of the plaintiff is?
What the periodic payments are designed to do are to mirror the ongoing needs of the injured party.
And follow up?
Yes.
And if the plaintiff dies prior to full payment being made, are you limiting what type of payments are not going to be still recoverable by the estate?
The California statute allows for continued payment of potential lost wages, but if there's an economic damage component that deals with ongoing medical care, then that particular portion ends.
Clarification?
Yes.
So that one part is economic damages that would be the result of their medical conditions or needs that would still need to be paid if they were alive.
Correct.
Thank you.
Representative Ackerman.
Yes. The court has the duty here to inquire into the financial status of the person and also can consider the installment payments be made through a trust fund, an annuity, or other form of security. My question is that inquiry into the financial status of the person only limited to a person, or would it go to the vehicle that may be making the payments, such as a trust fund, annuity, or other financial device?
In the settlements that we do on a structured basis, and they tend to be settlements outside of the before a verdict, what is generally done is that you purchase an annuity from a A-rated or better life insurance company, and then you have another highly rated insurance company guarantee that stream of payment. And I would anticipate that most, if not all, of the payments would be on that basis. So it would have the court looking at the financial security of the provider of the annuity and the guarantor.
So the answer is yes, and person would include any financial entity that would be responsible for making the installment payments.
Correct.
Thank you.
All right, are there other questions?
I have a comment, Mr. Chair.
Comments are acceptable.
Early on, and I haven't looked at this file in some time, I did get an email from legislative counsel suggesting that this installment payment plan is subject to constitutional challenge. And I don't know if you heard anything about that, Mr. Chair, but I think we should have more information about that before we proceed.
Okay. I'll ask you to work with counsel in providing that information. Do you want me to pass on that or give me a copy?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Ackerman, I am aware of that concern, that was one of the reasons to make it discretionary. But obviously, there is some concern that I tended to not
in drafting the amendments, I tended to not want to get us into the situation where it's like the lottery, where they say, you know, look, you can have the full value of your judgment over the next 30 years, or you can take something much, much less, but which is what you'd actually realize as a lump sum payment right now. And that wasn't the intent of the bill, was to somehow make it so that, you know, the lump, in the end, people just go with the lump sum. And I thought that that might avoid the constitutional problem. But
okay, anything else? Thank you, gentlemen. Stu Brown from the Procedure and Practice section of the bar. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Stuart Brown. I'm testifying on behalf of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee. I do have to say that I think this amendment satisfies a great deal of our concerns, and it actually looks better to me than I thought any structured payment plan would look like. I do have to say that I do agree with the previous testimony regarding the distinction between reduction in present value and gross amount. I think there's a problem there that needs to be addressed. Additionally, there is an allowance. The court can require security. They are not required to require security for any structured payment plan. But if one looks at subsection 7, the judgment does not become a lien on the real property of the judgment debtor. That would cause us a problem. We did raise this previously. We would respectfully suggest that subsection 7 be conditioned upon the requirement that proper security be provided, that the court require proper security. And in that case, then there would be no reason, I think, for a judgment to become a lien on real property. Those are our comments.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Brown? Thank you very much. I'm going to close the work session on House Bill 2591. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3338. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 3338, if you recall, is the adoption bill that we heard just last week. There were some additional changes, and what you have before you is a dash two set of amendments. If you remember, this bill deals a lot largely with the situation where either the adoptive parents or the adoptive child are residents or are transient through the state. And we don't necessarily have quite the final version of the amendment before us, but if, with the chair's indulgence, we could do some on-the-record hand engrossing of your dash twos, I could show you what the final version is supposed to look like, and then we could make a decision as to whether we'd feel comfortable enough going forward with these amendments, either conceptually amended further, or we want to wait for the final dash threes, which I hoped to have ready today, but unfortunately are not.
Who's our team on this one? Robin, Nancy, yeah, come on up.
Hello, Chair Williams and members of the committee. We've conferred after the hearing last week, and Nancy Miller and Kathy Ledesma, we worked out some changes and some requested changes to the Dash 1 amendments that they wanted, and we've all agreed, we've compromised, and except for two small changes, which Mr. Joseph is aware of, we're all set.
And the small changes are?
The small changes would be on.
And they're agreed to among the three of you?
They
well?
Are. We had actually agreed to them, and they got missed by Legislative Council, I think.
Okay, what?
I know, you're stunned.
We're done.
Frankly, I'm not sure I believe it either. So
it's a gender issue, I think.
Given my experience today. A little
louder. It's a gender issue, I'm sure.
Kathy, I'd just I'd have you acknowledge the committee that you're appearing in front of. Look around the table.
Won't touch that one, Mr. Chair.
All right. Tell us where the amendments are, and then let's talk about what this does.
On page 2, line 13, the word after petition or should read and instead of or. And on page 2, lines 29 and 30, the very last sentence, all conferences shall be recorded. That sentence should have been deleted.
Which one was that?
The line 29 and 30, the very last sentence on page 2, it says all conferences shall be recorded. That should be deleted in its entirety. And that's it.
Those
and
are the two changes?
That's it.
Okay, then recap for us as we sort of transition from our last subject matter to this one. Tell us what this amendment does.
All right. There are actually two sections to the amendment. The first subsection has to do with Representative Krummel's initial House Bill 3338 regarding essentially mostly step-parent adoptions, but not completely step-parent adoptions, where we are instructing the court to, we're saying the court may consider, among other factors the court finds relevant, whether a custodial parent has attempted, without good cause shown, to prevent or impede contact between the child and the parents whose parental rights would be terminated. And that is to make sure that the courts look at issues such as those before they terminate someone's parental rights. And that was a very important issue to Representative Krummel and his constituent. Section 2, the amendments, what we're doing there is we are providing a process for the judiciary in Oregon to look at the adoptions of adults by other adults, and that's because a number of the judges in Oregon have been seeing cases where they suspect some elder abuse or fraud is occurring but haven't felt that the current statutory scheme allowed them to look further into the matter.
Okay. Questions for the panel? All right. We're in work session. Who wants to walk us through the conceptual amendments to the dash twos?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krummel.
Thank you. I would be happy to walk us through the conceptual amendments. And so I would, you want that in the form of a motion, I presume?
I do.
Okay. I would like to conceptually amend the dash two amendments that on line 13, page 2, change the or to and. So the sentence will read allegations set forth in the petition and attach affidavit that each petitioner, and then it goes on from there. And then on page 2, lines 29 and 30, at the end of line 29 it says all conferences, and then into line 30 shall be recorded, that be stricken or deleted.
Representative Krummel moves that we conceptually amend the dash 2 amendments to 3338 by striking the word or on line 13 and by eliminating the sentence beginning on line 29, all conferences, and eliminating the remainder of the sentence on line 30. Is there any objection?
And adding the word and.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, and on line 13, adding the word and. I apologize. Is there any objection? The amendment is conceptually amended. Representative Krummel?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would move the dash 2 amendments as conceptually amended into House Bill 3338.
Representative Krummel moves the dash 2 amendments as conceptually amended into House Bill 3338. Is there any discussion on his motion? Is there any objection? They're in the bill.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Krummel.
I would move House Bill 3338 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krummel moves House Bill 3338 as amended and conceptually amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Hearing none, Nancy, call the roll. Excused.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Aye.
Hanson?
Aye.
Krummel?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Zavon?
Aye.
Aye.
House Bill 3338 is amended. Goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krummel, I assume you'd like to carry it.
I would be delighted to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank
Yeah, we're gonna skip 3385. It was going to be a lot like the first four bills we heard. So they just need to work more on their amendments, maybe.
That one.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe we'll never see it again. I haven't figured that out. While we've got everybody here, you notice possible measure introduction. You have in front of you LC-221. LC-221 provides that a physician is agent of the Department of Human Services under Oregon Tort Claims Act for purposes of medical services provided to a person enrolled in the Oregon Health Plan. We've been green-lighted by the Speaker's office to introduce this bill as a committee bill, and the chair would so move. Is there any discussion on that? Any objection? Okay, the bill will be introduced as a committee bill. Now we're going to go to Senate Bill 37, and I'll open a work session.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. House Bill 37, Senate Bill 37, which we heard last week, just needed some conflict amendments with Senate Bill 118, which dealt with the same statutes. Those conflict amendments are actually rather lengthy, and you should see them in a set of dash ones at the bottom of your stack, I believe. With those, I think we're ready to go. And if you remember, what Senate Bill 37 does is it allows a person other than the elder or disabled person to file a petition on behalf of the elderly or disabled person where they are unable to do so and they're subject to some type of financial or physical abuse or that type of thing, or they need some other type of court assistance. And so all the dash ones do, as I understand it, they're just the conflict amendments from LC that we did not have in our possession last week.
All right. Is there anybody here to talk to 37?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Wright, and I'm the chair of the Elder Law Section of the Bar. I'd like to introduce Joanna Harbor, my law student who I'm torturing today.
Hi.
And the amendments achieve the purpose intended, and we support and hope that the committee will support the bill.
Good. So you've had a chance to look at the conflict amendments.
Yes, they look just fine.
You're comfortable with them. All right. And I appreciate
the coffee guy's here.
The coffee guy's here. Well, it was bad in your committee when they just eliminated coffee altogether, but it's bad enough in this committee. They got poor Representative Crummell now having to go out and make it.
I'm working on my new career. My legislative career goes in the tank.
You know, Representative Crummell, tomorrow would appreciate it if you'd bring some bagels in with you, too.
I could do that, sure.
Mr. Chair, I think actually Representative Kitts actually has this new facility that you may be able to get some employment.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, then the chair would move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 37. Thank you. Hope you enjoyed the show today. For Senate Bill 37, is there any discussion on the Dash 1s? Any objection? The coffee fairy has visited us, I just wanted.
I wonder how much money it saves to deliver it but not bring it in the room.
A lot of trouble does it, huh?
The Dash 1s are in the bill. And chair would move Senate Bill 37 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Nancy, call the roll.
Ackerman?
Aye.
Anderson?
Aye.
Barker?
Senator Barker?
Yes,
aye.
Crummell?
Aye.
McPherson?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 37 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on or a volunteer carrier on this one? Anybody who does a lot of this kind of work who feels comfortable carrying the bill?
I'll carry it. I can post about one.
I won't arm wrestle over.
I think Representative Przanski is also carrying 118 in there. Deal with the same issue, if I remember correctly. I can't exactly recall, but
I'll be glad to carry it.
Okay. Representative Przanski, then.
Okay, now 35.
All right, now we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 35. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 35, if you recall, deals with when a fiduciary seeks to hire, and I think this was a little confusing last time we heard this bill, but seeks to hire someone with whom they have a pecuniary or financial interest to do something on behalf of the person that is subject to the fiduciary relationship. In other words, it's anticipated this would be hiring a spouse or a relative or somebody who is, you know, hiring your own business or a business you have an interest in to do something. This will require court approval. Last time we heard the bill, there were some concerns that there might be some amendments necessary from the bankers. And in the meantime, it's come to light, according to LC, that those amendments are unnecessary. And it's my understanding that Tim Markey is currently going down to get Holly Robinson, who's going to come up and testify to that effect, which I understand will satisfy Mr. Martinez's clients that this is not necessary. However, in the meantime, it's my understanding that the bar has also noticed a technical revision that they needed in one of their amendments, and I believe Susan Graby is here to testify about that while we're waiting for LC to come up.
You want to come up, Ms. Professor? You can come up, too, with you, please. And bring your lawsuit. I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Joanna Harbor.
Hi, Joanna. Welcome. I think you originally said Tim Markey.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, Tim. No, it's Tim Martinez.
Tim Markey and Jim Martinez.
Yeah.
We'll just mix them all up. All right. So, why don't you share with us what the status is?
Chair Williams, members of the committee. My name is Susan Graby. I'm with Oregon State Bar, and the Dash 1 amendments that the bar has requested are to clarify in the bill that the bill really does what it's supposed to do, and that is to ensure that the court does approve payment for compensation to people who are persons who are employed by the fiduciary before those services are provided. They want to make sure that there is...
There's Tim Markey right now. That's right. You go ahead, and then I'll bring them up in just a second.
It's simply to clarify that that is the case, and the bill does what we wanted it to do, to make sure there's court approval before the payment is made.
Okay. Professor, do you have anything to add?
No, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that the Dash 1s do achieve the purpose of the bill, and we support them.
Okay. All right. Why don't we go ahead then? Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, Representative Jensen.
In relationship to this, how picky are we going to be in things like significant other, perhaps rather than spouse, or things like stepchild? Are those? That's a question that I don't understand whether it wouldn't make a difference or not. And if it would, why?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Jensen, I think the language is a language that was discussed both on the committee and with some of the other interested parties, and it was the language that we had worked out with the Real Estate Commission and in discussions with the OBA, that this was a list of parties that were appropriate. Doesn't mean that there may be some others that might not be appropriate to include.
But a situation... I mean, you might be able to get child within stepchild, but the issue of the significant other that's not a spouse, you're probably not going to pick up for disclosure purposes. Is that right, Professor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Denson, that's correct. They were not anticipated to be caught up in this one. This concept really grew out of some concerns specifically seen by judges, and I think that issue wasn't raised by the judges when we first began speaking about it, but it is something that perhaps should be discussed and considered in the interim. It's a good point.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I didn't, you know.
The point is that on these disclosure situations like this where you're paying somebody who's got a relationship, I mean, you can't write them in such a way. It's difficult to write them because it could include the best friend across the street or, the guy who's on your bowling team. I mean, and so how do you define those relationships in a way where you have to always get disclosure? The broader you make it, the larger the likelihood of objection it gets.
Mr. Chair, in light of the society, though, that we live in today, the relationships that some people have, not marriages or spouses because of other perhaps legal impairments that might be, you know, in their way, and for other practices, may function in that capacity, and that's the reason for my.
No, it's a, I think it's a here. Yeah, it's a appropriate question.
Okay, thank you. Tim Marquis and Holly, if you want to come on up.
Mr. Chair, I think just to set the record straight, Mr. Marquis probably better say his name.
I'm sorry,
for the record.
It's Jim Martinez. I forgot.
And Jim Martinez here on the.
Sitting next to Joan Robinson.
Joan Robinson, yeah. Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. We testified on this bill earlier. We had a question, wanted to make sure that banks and trust companies were exempt from the requirements of this bill. We asked to have an amendment drafted. Legal counsel, legislative counsel, found a statute that protects what we're after, so with her blessing, we're comfortable.
Ms. Robinson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Holly Robinson, Legislative Council. And I have to say, having Mr. Martinez escort me up here was probably a lot like what the members experience when a sergeant-at-arms comes and gets them for a call. It's time. I just wanted to point out, just for the record, as I told Mr. Martinez I would do, in 1999, when a lot of the provisions regarding fiduciaries and professional fiduciaries was enacted, there was a section of Oregon law, ORS 125-242, that had a specific exemption for financial institutions and trust companies as defined in 706-008. And the two sections of Oregon law that were exempt, that from which banks, financial institutions, and trusts are exempted are, in fact, 125-225, which is the conflicts of interest statute, and also the provisions relating to professional fiduciaries. By just opening the book, I accomplished what Mr. Martinez asked me to do.
Mm-hmm. Okay, fair enough. Are there questions for either of these?
Well, can't we have a bill anyway? I mean, we do this a lot, don't we?
What, just a little amendment to say what's already been said?
Uh-huh. Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, if you meant it the first time, maybe you really mean it the second time.
All right, thank you both. It's sufficient for you, Tim, that it's just that gets on the record, right? Okay. All right, so we've got the -1 amendments then to Senate Bill 35. Their discussion. Do we have
Chair,
a motion? Representative Shetterly?
I'd move the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 35.
Representative Shetterly moves the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 35. Is there discussion on his motion? Is there objection? The ones are in.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I move Senate Bill 35 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves Senate Bill 35 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on that motion? Call the roll, please.
Ackerman.
Aye.
Aye.
Barker.
Aye.
Jensen.
Aye.
Rummel.
Aye.
McPherson.
Aye.
Zagoski.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Shetterly.
Aye.
Senate Bill 35 is amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier on that one? Representative McPherson? Okay. All right. Fine. Committee, that concludes our agenda for the afternoon. Thank you for your interest.
We have a meeting tomorrow.
Right, it's Friday.
Just let everybody know.
Yeah, everybody should know we have a meeting on Friday. Yeah, we're done with Fridays off probably from now until the committee's adjourned, I would suspect.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Since the pro tem's here, are we going beyond noon tomorrow?
I'm going to adjourn, by the way, so we're just...